Okay, you should be good. Recording is started and
Okay. So hello friends. Welcome to this 54th webinar on the secret teachings of all ages by Manly P. Hall. This webinar series is available on Makara.us under the subheading Moray Federation Webinars, then Webinar Series in Progress, as shown here. Previous episodes of this, the Secret Doctrine and the Treatise on Cosmic Fire series, are also available on YouTube. Just do a search for Francis Donald and the webinar series you wish to view. You can join any of these webinars on the homepage of MoriaFederation.com. Probably most of you get notices in the mail that you can click on, but if you are missing one, you can always come here up in the upper left-hand corner. You can find the links for these webinar series. Alrighty then. We began last session with a new section called The Birthday of the Sun, where we learned that the birthdays of nearly all pagan sun gods, from Balder in the north to Osiris in Egypt, from Mithras to Sol Invictus, all the birthdays of all these avatars was placed on December 25th, which, as declared by Julius Caesar, was also considered to be the winter solstice. This universal alignment of birthday and solstice shows an understanding among the ancients of the true nature of all solar avatars. And this understanding has largely been lost in present-day Christianity. We then took a look at the Roman Emperor Julian's Hymn to the Sun, which praises the sun god Mithras, the Persian deity of light and truth. This poem also reflects Julian's political and religious views as he contrasts the sun god with the Christian god, whom he considered to be an inferior and false god. I want to reread this first line because it shows the universality of his perspective. I call on you, you who surround all things in every language and in every dialect. I hymn you. We then took a look at the similarities between the avatar Jesus and those sun gods that preceded him. For example, the virgin birth, also attributed to Horus, Mithras, Dionysus, and Krishna, miracles, which were also performed by Asclepius, Dionysus, Osiris, and Attis, and death and resurrection, also experienced by Tammuz, Adonis, Attis, and Osiris. And this is significant because it shows the universality of the nature of a solar avatar. It's not about the personality and the specific events of that avatar's life, except for in so much as they align with this universal quality of the avatar. We then read about the Assumption of the Virgin and the Catholic feasts celebrating this event. This led to an animated discussion on the subject of Mary's virginity, which some believe to be a literal physical virginity, and others to indicate a state of purity representing an initiate status. During this section on Mary, we took a look at her celestial counterpart, Astraea, who was a celestial virgin and the last of the immortals to live with humans during the Satya Yuga, shown up here at top. We then read a quote from esoteric astrology that describes Eve, Isis, and Mary's representing the mental, astral, and physical aspects of Virgo. And this takes us up to where we left off. So, next up, the last paragraph on the section entitled The Birthday of the Sun. Could we get a reader, please?
I'll start us off.
Sounds good.
Among certain of the Arabian and Persian astronomers, the three stars forming the sword belt of Orion were called the Magi, who came to pay homage to the young sun god. The author of Mankind, Their Origin and Destiny, contributes the following additional information. In Cancer, which had risen to the meridian at midnight, is the constellation of the stable and the ass. Ancients called it Persepi Jovis or Hovis. In the north, the stars of the bear are seen, called by the Arabians Martha and Mary, and also the coffin of Lazarus. Thus, the esotericism of pagandom was embodied in Christianity, although its keys are lost. The Christian church blindly follows ancient customs, and when asked for a reason, gives superficial and unsatisfactory explanations, either forgetting or ignoring the indisputable fact that each religion is based upon the secret doctrines of its predecessor.
Thanks, Pia. Okay, first, among certain of the Arabian and Persian astronomers, the three stars forming the sword belt of Orion were called the Magi, who came to pay homage to the young sun god. So the Magi was a name given to Zoroastrian priests. There is a prophecy in the Book of Numbers which says, quote, a star will come out of Jacob, a scepter will rise out of Israel. The three stars of Orion's belt point to Sirius. So possibly the biblical scepter is Orion's belt, and the star that will come out of Jacob is Sirius. Nothing definitive here. These are all theories, and they've been talking about this ever since the birth of Christ. The Egyptians believed that Osiris' belt represented the resting place of the soul of Osiris. In ancient Mesopotamia, Orion's belt represented the sky god Anu, their highest god. Whereas in ancient Scandinavia, Orion's belt represented Frigg's distaff. Now, Frigg was the goddess of wisdom, marriage, and fate, and spun the threads of life for all beings. A distaff, shown here, is a tool used to hold unspun fibers. So it's an interesting idea that Orion's belt represented this source of the form aspect for the solar system, and particularly in the nature of the Christ aspect. Many have speculated on the identity of the Star of Bethlehem, herald of Jesus's birth. For example, there was a conjunction of Jupiter and Saturn in Pisces in 7 BC, which was considered a rare and auspicious event by ancient astrologers. But though this conjunction was astrologically auspicious, it wouldn't have even been as bright as Sirius on a normal night. It would have been bright, but not like what you see here. Others have conjectured that there was a supernova, which can shine brightly for up to a year just before Jesus's birth. But you know, if you're the Magi were very possibly, very likely, I should say, also astrologers, and they could have been following a star of this conjunction, for instance, of Jupiter and Saturn, without it being particularly bright, just because they knew where to look in the heavens. There's been lots of theories on what may have been the Star of Bethlehem. Nothing definitive as nothing that everybody agrees on has come forth. Okay, next up, the author of Mankind, Their Origin and Destiny contributes the following additional information. In Cancer, which had risen to the meridian at midnight, is the constellation of the stable and of the ass. So interesting. The ancients called it Praesepe Jovis. I'm guessing at the pronunciation. As mentioned before, the author of Mankind, Their Origin and Destiny was Arthur Thompson. As to the term Praesepe Jovis, Praesepe is the Latin name for the star cluster called by astronomers M44 in the constellation of Cancer, as described here, known as both the Beehive Cluster and the Manger. Jovis is the Roman name for Jupiter. Therefore, Praesepe Jovis could be translated as the manger of Jupiter, or representing this conjunction of Jupiter and the manger. And since, Jupiter is the second ray lord, its conjunction with the manger would be an appropriate celestial event for the birth of a Christ overshadowed avatar like Jesus, even so possibly in a literal manger, even though more esoterically, he is thought to have been born in a cave. By the way, if you have any thoughts or questions, anytime, comments, thoughts, questions, please raise your hand. It's always more interesting when we have a bit of a conversation, a bit of a dialogue, than me just droning on. Okay, next up. In the north, the stars of the bear are seen, called by the Arabians Martha and Mary, and also the coffin of Lazarus. Thus, the esotericism of pagandom was embodied in Christianity, although its keys are lost. Okay, so the quadrangle of the Dipper represents the coffin of Lazarus, and the three stars of the handle represent Jesus and the two sisters who are following the coffin and mourning. The middle star of the handle, which is actually a double star system called Mizar and Alcor, represent the daughter and son of Lazarus who have been left behind. The pole star represents the murderer of Lazarus, who is named Al-Jadi in Arabic. So the quadrangle of stars representing the coffin could represent what AAB calls the imprisoning of spirit in the chains of matter. Because, Lazarus is a kind of a personification of the idea of incarnation and death, right? And so that quality of transition. Actually, I don't find any of this to be particularly esoteric. When you call the pole star the Lazarus's murderer, obviously you're not getting to the essence of what these stars are about. So, I mean, there is a first ray quality to the Great Bear, which is certainly associated with death, or death meaning transition, and the Christ with resurrection, both themes of the Lazarus story. Nevertheless, I suspect that these Bible story names that the Arabs placed on these stars veils their true meaning. There's a much more esoteric understanding. I mean, even DK gives a very in-depth teaching on the Great Bear. Okay, I saw a hand go up.
Yes. Go ahead, please, Greg.
The esoteric teaching behind the Great Bear is, when I relate back to it, it's of course the seven brothers, but then the seven sisters would be like the Pleiadians or the Pleiades, and that together we get to Sirius, which is the angle of the would be down in the lower left or center part of this sky picture. But yet why would they qualify, or maybe that's just the Arabian interpretation of Martha and Mary, and then the other one, the third expression in this part around the handle part.
Yeah, Jesus was the third expression. And then you have the brother and son and daughter of Lazarus. But like I said, I really don't think you're going to find much esoteric revelation through, comparing the Great Bear of all constellations, to this very, very local Bible story of Lazarus. This has much more cosmic significance, which you pointed out, it being the seven brothers, or it's really the father aspect to the mother aspect of the Pleiades, and it's the source of the seven rays, even though as a whole the constellation represents the first ray.
Since it's the first ray that's been manifest through all seven levels, because the first ray has seven sub rays.
And you can look at it that way. You can look at it that way. At one point, Michael Robbins identifies each star with each of the sub rays. Since DK doesn't give us that info, he was speculating, but there are stories about these stars. There's a great book called Star Names that gives all the known stories about these stars, and from those you can speculate about which subray of the first ray these stars might represent. But they overall, the thing to know is that this is the source of the spirit aspect for our solar system, and they're the prototypes also of the seven sacred planets, each of the planets having a monadic source point in these seven rays, seven stars of the Great Bear. Now, whether they're literally, they're the monads of our very insignificant seven planets is hard to say. We can't know that, but there's much more to it than the story of Lazarus. Anyway, thank you, Greg.
Okay, thank you. All right.
Okay, anyone else? Okay, next, finally, the Christian church blindly follows ancient customs and, when asked for a reason, gives superficial and unsatisfactory explanations, either forgetting or ignoring the indisputable fact that each religion is based upon the secret doctrines of its predecessors. It's a really important statement. This concluding sentence references the church's concerted effort to obfuscate rather than build on the secret doctrines of the mystery schools of the past. For instance, if you look at an Egyptian temple, if you look at between the walls, the fill that they used to bolster the strength of the walls of the temples was made up of the walls of the previous temples. That's how we're able to know That's where archaeological evidence of really early temples has come to us from, is reconstructing this fill layer. But the point here being that they recognize the importance of the traditions that went before, and that they were animated by the same secret doctrine, as he says here, and therefore were built upon, literally, in the case of the Egyptian temples, they were literally built upon the remains of the previous temples. So the tragic intention of the Christian church, instigated by Saul of Tarsus, has led to the belief, still held by most Christians, that Jesus is the only Son of God, thus perpetuating the heresy of separativeness. Okay, next up. Can we get a reader, please? New section called The Three Sons.
Yvonne, can you read that for us, please?
Sure. The three sons, the solar orb, like the nature of man, was divided by the ancient sages into three separate bodies. According to the mystics, there are three suns in each solar system, analogous to the three centers of life in each individual constitution. These are called three lights: the spiritual sun, the intellectual or solar sun, and the material sun, now symbolized in Freemasonry by three candles. The spiritual sun manifests the power of God, the Father. The solar sun radiates the life of God, the Son. And the material sun is the vehicle of manifestation for God, the Holy Spirit. Man's nature was divided by the mystics into three distinct parts: spirit, soul, and body. The physical body was unfolded and vitalized by the material sun. His spiritual nature was illuminated by the spiritual sun, and his intellectual nature was redeemed by the true light of grace, the solar sun. The alignment of these three globes in the heavens was one explanation offered for the peculiar fact that the orbits of the planets are not circular, but elliptical.
Thank you, Yvonne. So first, the solar orb, like the nature of man, was divided by the ancient sages into three separate bodies. According to the mystics, there are three suns in each solar system, analogous to the three centers of life in each individual constitution. These are called the three lights: the spiritual sun, the intellectual or solar sun, and the material sun, now symbolized in Freemasonry by three candles. So the doctrine of the three sons is a core tenet of theosophy, which through the works of AAB has been developed to a far greater degree than any previous author, even HPB, who acknowledges the existence of the three sons. But it was really through the Master Dwar Kul that this teaching came to the front. The three sons are modern theosophy, are the central spiritual sun, the heart of the sun, and the physical sun, whose microcosmic correspondences are the monad, soul, and personality. Can we get a reader for this, please? And by the way, these are the three candles of Freemasonry that represent these three suns, even though maybe most of the members in the lodge wouldn't know the true purpose of these three candles. They do, in essence, in the original form of Masonry, represent the three sons. So can we get a reader for this, please?
Vivian, can you read for us, please?
A, the physical sun and its relation to prana and the etheric body. B, the subjective sun and its connection with the astral plane, with the karma manasic principle and the astral body. C, the central spiritual sun and its relation to the spirit or atma in man. D, the heart of the sun and its relation to the lower and higher mental bodies, producing that peculiar manifestation we call the causal body. In this connection, it must be remembered that the force which flows from the heart of the sun works through a triangle formed by the Venusian scheme, the earth and the sun.
Thank you, Vivian. Oh, by the way, there are, you know, 9 instances of the term subjective sun in the blue books. If you do a word search, you'll get 9 hits. Almost all of them, in fact, all but one, describe subjective sun as being the same as the heart of the sun. They're synonyms. Only this listing breaks it apart, where you have a separate instance of the subjective sun and the heart of the sun. I thought it was interesting enough to pull up for that reason. Next up, the spiritual sun manifests the power of God, the Father. The solar sun radiates the life of God, the Son, and the material sun is the vehicle of manifestation for God, the Holy Spirit. Pretty straightforward. Man's nature was divided by the mystics into 3 distinct parts: spirit, soul, and body. Okay. Because the doctrine of 3 suns is such a key part of the Ageless Wisdom teachings, and really, even though he gives it a whole section, Manly only barely touches on this. So for that reason, we're going to take a look at some additional correspondences. So could we get a reader? This is all from different Alice Bailey source material. I think most of it's from Treatise on Cosmic Fire. So a reader just to read across the top, to read these horizontally.
Martha, can you do that for us, please?
Yes, I can. Central spiritual sun, the electric fire, spirit/life, Shiva/Agni, destroyer, energy, the mystery of fire itself, influencing the mutable cross. Heart of the sun. Shall I keep going, Francis?
Yeah.
Heart of the sun. Solar flyer, soul/consciousness, Vishnu/Surya, preserver, light, the mystery of polarity, influencing the fixed cross. The physical visible sun, fire by friction, form/personality, Brahma, creator, Fohat, the mystery of electricity.
And before you read this last, I think these are reversed. It seems to me the central spiritual sun influences the cardinal cross, and the physical visible sun influences the mutable cross. Now, I'm going to have to go into TCF, find this chart, and make sure about that. If it's correct, that's going to take some
unpacking.
Yeah, it's going to take some unpacking. That would be a head scratcher. But you can see how the natural correlation would be with the cardinal cross for the central spiritual sun, because it's the highest spiritual cross. But anyway, thank you,
Francis. Yeah. Even in reversing it, when you do that search, it's interesting. It seems a line that Fohat would influence the cardinal cross. So perhaps the shift occurred earlier in the paradigm. I'm not sure.
Oh, I see what you mean. Well, Fohat is a function of the creator. The creator is an aspect of Brahma,
Okay.
Where using Fohat, he binds spirit and matter together, whereas energy is that pure force of the spirit,
okay,
of the spiritual sense. So
thank
I
you.
This is,
yeah,
this is correct.
Thank you.
In fact, I think all the columns are right on.
Aligned. They're all aligned. Yes.
Except for
the last one. Uh-huh. Thank you.
Maybe he just wanted to see if we were awake. I saw a hand go up.
Okay, sorry. Hold on a minute here. I was looking it up in TCF.
Okay, well, I could just call on Greg. You can continue looking it up. Yeah, go ahead, Greg.
Okay. Well, when I'm in TCF, they really talk, DK really talks about the central spiritual sun and the electric fire is much more wheel oriented in terms of the first ray. And then the heart of the sun as solar fire is, of course, us as the embodiment or and here, the way it says here, it's the Vishnu Surya preserver aspect, which would definitely mean the fixed cross. And I would say with you, Francis, that it's probably that it is opposite, because the physical visible sun, the fire by friction, it's a most potent and fire energy that we deal with here on planet Earth in terms of the releasing of the atom and the whole network of the planes and the human kingdom and the mineral kingdom and how that all kind of comes into play. And that's so powerful that we were able to create that. So I would say what you were saying, it's the same thing, is that Brahma is the everything that's emerges out of the interaction of all three of these. So yeah, it'd be really interesting to get a real clear sense of whether, but I've always seen the cardinal as the will aspect.
So how are we doing, BL? Did you find it?
I've too many references to,
you know,
I haven't found
always,
the actual table yet.
Yeah, I always put a page number. I wonder if I made this mistake. I may have cobbled together some charts and just myself mixed these up. But anyway,
that's possible, because I found some of these in different manners. But I also want to say that while the predominant mention is the physical and the mutable and the central spiritual sun and the cardinal, there's 1.1 part where he does switch that. And it has to do with a higher spiral, not the traditional one that we're used to. So, but I think he may have done that. I think he may have cobbled together several of the tables where he describes different aspects of this.
I think I did. Otherwise, I almost certainly would have put a page number, you know. So I bet I reverse these. That's my guess. Anyway, see how much more we know about it because we made a mistake. Anyway, could we get a reader for this second tally on the three suns?
Yeah, Greg.
Oh, look, read number three. Upon the cardinal cross, it is a central spiritual sun, which is called into play. There you have it, right there. So pardon me, but I'm going to go back. And
while Greg is getting ready to read, we have a comment here from Ariane. She says, I really appreciate equating the cardinal and the will.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. Okay, it's right now. We have it here. And now let me go back into play mode here. So we have it now in this description of that, you know, there's no question that that's the alignment. So, yeah, thank you.
And Just really quick, Greg, before you start, I did find a table with Agni, electric fire, spirit, central spiritual sun, but it doesn't have the crosses there. So, but anyway, it's got the Agni and electrical fire, Surya and solar fire, Brahma and fire by friction, equated with the central heart and physical respectively, and then the crosses aren't identified. But okay, anyway, I'm going to quit looking.
Yeah, I think you can at this point. Okay, Greg, take it away.
Okay. Number one, the physical sun, the anima mundi, the animal soul, multiplicity. Two, the heart of the sun, the human soul, and the divine ego, duality. Three, the central spiritual sun, the divine consciousness, the will of the whole, the awareness of God, unity, from Esoteric Astrology 296. One, upon the mutable cross, it is the physical sun and its influences which affect the man, stimulate the bodily cells, and sustain the form nature, affecting the centers below the diaphragm. Number two, upon the fixed cross, it is the heart of the sun, which is called into activity and which pours its energies through Neptune upon man. These stimulate and affect the heart, the throat, and the ajna centers. Number three, upon the cardinal cross, it is the central spiritual sun, which is called into play, and Uranus is then the distributing agency, and the head center becomes a center in the initiate's body through which direction and control come.
Thank you, Greg. So this is useful because it gives you further associations from this high cosmic place into the nature of this energy as it manifests in our solar system and what these suns affect. Okay, next up, reader for this. Hello, BL, are you there? Did we lose BL? Goodness gracious.
Okay. Maybe you did. Oh, Marianne, can you read that for us, please, Marianne? There we go.
Yes. The heart center in man opens a door into what is called the heart of the sun. The throat center opens a way into full understanding of the path of the physical sun, and all true astrologers must eventually have that center functioning. The head center opens a way to the central spiritual sun, each passing via the planetary correspondence to one of the cosmic planes.
Thank you, Marianne. And then finally, it's the last one. Reader, please.
Marguerite, can you read that for us, please? Marguerite?
Yeah, I'm here. Sure. The moment the initiate or the disciple sees, even dimly, the light of the spiritual triad which veils and hides the central spiritual sun, he realizes that all other lights, that of the atom of matter, that of the form, and that of the soul itself, must inevitably fade out in the stupendous glory and brilliance which emanate from God himself, and which he senses as in process of revelation. He becomes absorbed intellectually, intuitively, spiritually, and finally factually in that light.
Thank you. Okay, so hopefully we have a little more esoteric understanding of these three suns. But back to Manly P. Hall, I see a hand before we get going.
Yes. Go ahead, please, Gordon.
Yes. One of those, it just mentioned the cosmic planes. And I was wondering if the spiritual son is connected with the cosmic mental plane, and is part of the sun is cosmic astral plane.
Yes. Sorry, I was muted there. That's how I understand it. And in terms of, you know, where these great entities are ultimately, you know, you can see if we go back here, hang on a sec. I have to go back a bit. Yeah, here you see that he breaks out the subjective sun with its connection to the astral plane, and the heart of the sun relating to the mental body. And there's, you would take the higher course, cosmic correspondences to these, and you could place the heart of the sun at the level of the solar logoic causal body, and that would then be a direct upwards reflection of our causal body and our soul nature, you know, because the heart of the sun and the soul are directly in line, right? But then where do you put the central spiritual sun if you do that? You could put it at atmic levels, or you could bring the whole thing down as you suggest and put it on the three lower cosmic planes. But I think this statement about the heart of the sun suggests that you're looking at the causal body of the solar logos when you're looking at the heart of the sun, and that you would need to go to monadic levels of the solar logos in order to find this central spiritual sun. That's not definitive, sorry, but that's how I understand it. If anybody else has any input or memory of DK's teachings on this, that'd be great. Okay. So next up. In terms of the cosmic astral, it is our source of love in this solar system. It's, you know, it's not an emotionally, it's not about emotion at all. It's about the pure quality of love as we understand it, you know, in on our planet. So for that reason, you know, the heart of the sun and love, because the heart center is the source of love in our own microcosmic system. So you can see how you can look at it in two different ways. Okay, next up, his physical body was unfolded and vitalized by the material sun. Did we read this? No. His spiritual nature was illumined by the spiritual sun, and the intellectual was redeemed by the true light of grace, the solar sun. DK further describes the relationship between personality, soul, and monad with the three suns in this passage from Rays and Initiations. And maybe we'll get a little clarity on our other question as well. Could we get a reader, please?
Sure. Greg, I'm going to ask you to read that, but first let me read the comments that you have here. When you were talking about the love, Greg says agape versus bliss or romantic love.
Yeah, sure, exactly. Greg just read, though, so maybe we could find another reader.
Oh, did he? Sorry, I guess I missed that. All right, Catherine. Can you read?
Yes. The monad relates the initiate to the will of God, to the council at Shambhala, to forces active on the planet Pluto, and on another planet which must remain nameless and also to the central spiritual sun. 2, the soul relates the initiate to the love of God, to the consciousness aspect of deity, to the hierarchy as a whole, entering it through the ashram of the master who has aided him to take initiation, to the planets Venus and Mercury, to the sun Sirius, and to the heart of the sun. 3, the personality relates the initiate to the mind of God, to the intelligence principle of the planetary life, to humanity as a whole, to Saturn and Mars, and to the physical sun through its pranic aspect.
So you can see how this is a real useful description here, because especially because we get the nature of the constellations and the planets that are related to each principle. It's an important description here. Okay. Finally, the alignment of these three globes in the heavens, you know, sometimes it's a big shift to go between Manly P. Hall and DK, the Master DK. Here's an example of that big shift. The alignment of these three globes in the heavens was one explanation offered for the peculiar fact that the orbits of the planets are not circular, but elliptical. This is an interesting statement, given the fact that the heart of the sun and the central spiritual sun have no physical plane existence. But, you know, this doesn't absolutely rule out the idea that they couldn't have an energetic effect on the orbits of the planet. DK only indirectly addresses this phenomena in a treatise on white magic. Could we get a reader, please?
Yes. Magda, can you read that for us, please?
Hear me?
Yes.
Eventually, we find a solar system such as ours and myriads of others. A solar system functioning as a sun with its revolving and rotating planets, preserving their differing orbits, holding their stated and relative positions, active as independent and interdependent organisms, and yet presenting, to the eye of the astronomer, a coherence, a unity, and a structure that is unique in each case, and yet which functions under cosmic law. It measures up to some vast purpose, conceived and held steadily in the universal mind, which is in its turn an aspect of that group. One second. Of that group conscious and self-conscious entity, who is the author of its being and the creator of its form.
Okay, thank you. I found this to be an interesting symbol called the Triskelion, because it shows the three in one could represent. It's a solar symbol and might more esoterically represent the three suns, or it could represent the three logoi of our sun. It can represent both those things, because in both cases you have the three in one as an expression. Okay, next up, can we get a reader, please?
Yes. Kirsten, can you read that for us, please?
Yes. The pagan priests always considered the solar system as a grand man and drew the analogy of this three centers of activity from the three main centers of life in the human body: the brain, the heart, and the generative system. The Transfiguration of Jesus describes three tabernacles, the largest being in the center, the heart, and a smaller one on either side, the brain and the generative system. It is possible that the philosophical hypothesis of the existence of the three suns is based upon a peculiar natural phenomenon which has occurred many times in history. In the 51st year after Christ, three suns were seen at once in the sky, and also in the 66th year. In the 69th year, the two suns were seen together. According to William Lilly, between the years 1156 and 1648, 20 similar occurrences were recorded.
Thank you. Okay, first, the pagan priests always considered the solar system as a grand man and drew their analogy of these three centers of activity from the three main centers of life in the human body, the brain, the heart, and the generative system. So the brain, heart, and generative system correspond to the three logoi. As to the grand man, that's, you know, the three solar logoi. As to the grand man, Curtis is the key to the universe. Simply staged, each soul is a cell in the grand man, an atom in the soul of the universe, and has its own place in the grand plan. So this gives a little bit of perspective. The universal grand man is also called Macroprosopos, which just means large face, and Adam Kadmon. In the first volume of The Secret Doctrine, HPB describes this grand man's descent into matter. Could we get a reader, please?
Yes, Anne Parker, can you read that for us, please?
Yes.
The triad or triangle becomes tetractus, the sacred Pythagorean number, the perfect square, and a six-faced cube on Earth. The macroprosopus, the great face, is now microprosopus, the lesser face, or as the Kabbalists have it, the Ancient of Days, descending on Adam Kadmon, whom he uses as his vehicle to manifest through, gets transformed into tetragrammaton. It is now in the lap of Maya, the great illusion, and between itself and the reality has the astral light, the great deceiver of man's limited senses.
Okay. Thank you, Anne. Questions? Thoughts, questions about this? So, you know, she describes a descent here, right? With the microprosopus and macroprosopus, so the greater face and the lesser face. And on our planet, the lesser face is the Ancient of Days, who is Sanat Kumara. He's, you know, for us, the great face, but cosmically speaking, he's precipitates from an even greater being, right? Okay. Next, we have the Transfiguration of Jesus describes three tabernacles. The largest being in the center, the heart, and a smaller one on either side, the brain and the generative system. So the text refers to Luke 9:33, in which Peter says, "Master, it is good for us to be here. Let us make three tabernacles, one for you and one for Moses and one for Elijah," not knowing what he was saying, meaning, you know, not being aware of a true understanding of Christ's position, you know, as representing one of the principles of the planetary logos. So the priority given to the heart, you know, the one in the center, is because Christ represents the second or soul aspect. And because this is a second ray solar system. In early temples, the three tabernacles were represented by three courts, the outer, the inner, which would, outer would represent the third aspect, the inner court would represent that Christ aspect, the the soul aspect. And finally, at the very center of that inner court, the Holy of Holies, the smallest one. That would be inside this large enclosure here. This was also an architectural design used in ancient Egyptian temples. Esoterically, the source of energy for these three tabernacles and courts are the three suns. If you could add another column here, you could describe the outer court, the inner court, and the Holy of Holies. Finally, MPH cites a number of historical sightings of three suns. This is totally esoteric. I mean, I know it took place because of what comes next, but to describe them as three visible suns in our solar system is a very exoteric understanding. So the Natural Genesis describes some of these instances of this appearance. Can we get a reader, please, for this?
Okay, but first we got a hand up. Go ahead, please, Greg.
When you speak of Elias and Moses and which the three tabernacles are being built for, aren't they the three that Christ, as described in the Bible, that came at his transfiguration when all the other disciples, with the other two were, that he took with him, were asleep? Isn't those three the ones that are presumably the ones who said, first God says, here is my son Jesus Christ,
Moses was, of course, carried the law and came before Christ, as did Elijah, who was considered to be an earlier incarnation of Christ. So it represents the Moses, I would guess, would represent the outer court because it's the literal physical tablet of the law. Elijah would represent the Holy of Holies, and the Christ would represent the inner court. That's my guess.
Okay.
You have, what you're citing is John, who was the only one allowed to stay with Christ during his third initiation. It was really a recapitulation because he was able to withstand that potency. But in terms of what aspects they represented, I couldn't say.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So we're talking about these three suns as seen in the sky. That's what we're talking about now. And this is strictly MPH stuff, right? So if we could get a reader for this, please.
Anne Veronica, can you read that for us, please?
Okay.
Anne Veronica, there you go.
Yes.
In the ninth of Hugo, the Pratus Sermons, Dominicales, he says of the Nativity of Christ, on this day there appeared in the east three suns, which were immediately joined into one to signify that the three, i.e. divinity, soul, and flesh, are combined in Christ. The old Adam of the flesh, he says, was combined with a newly created soul and the deity to make one son, one man, Jesus Christ.
Thank you, Anne Veronica. Okay. So there has been, a number of instances of the appearance of suns in the sky, which have been interpreted in different ways. In truth, the specter of three suns is an uncommon but photographically documented phenomenon called parhelion. And, you know, when I first saw this picture, I figured, oh, it's one of those things that only takes place in the north. But then when I, with a little further research, I found that actually this happens very occasionally. Pretty much it can happen anywhere in the world. So could we get a reader for this? This is a strictly a Wikipedia kind of a thing that describes what's going on here.
A sun dog, also called a parhelion in meteorology, is an atmospheric optical phenomenon that consists of a bright spot to one or both sides of the sun. Two sun dogs often flank the sun within a 22-degree halo. The sun dog is a member of the family of the halos caused by the refraction of sunlight by ice crystals in the atmosphere. Sun dogs typically appear as a pair of subtly colored patches of light around 22 degrees to the left and right of the sun, and at the same altitude above the horizon as the sun. They can be seen anywhere in the world during any season, but are not always obvious or bright. Sun dogs are best seen and most conspicuous when the sun is near the horizon.
Thank you, BL. Okay, I thought this was interesting. I knew nothing about this. All right, next up, could we get a reader, please?
Yvonne, can you read that for us? Here, let me, there you go. You should be able to unmute.
Okay. Yeah, that sun dog, that was interesting. I never saw that before. I would think it was three suns too.
Yeah.
The three suns. Recognizing the sun as the supreme benefactor of the material world, Hermetists believed that there was a spiritual sun which ministered to the needs of the invisible and divine part of nature, human and universal. Anent this subject, the great Paracelsus wrote, "There is an earthly sun which is the cause of all heat, and all who are able to see may see the sun, and those who are blind and cannot see him may feel his heat. There is an external sun."
Eternal.
There is an eternal sun, which is the source of all wisdom and those whose spiritual senses have awakened to life will see that sun and be conscious of his existence. But those who have not attained spiritual consciousness may yet feel his power by an inner faculty, which is called intuition. Certain Rosicrucian scholars have given special appellations to these three phases of the sun. The spiritual sun they called Vulcan, the solar and intellectual sun, Christ and Lucifer, respectively, and the material sun, the Jewish Demiurgus Jehovah. Lucifer here represents the intellectual mind without the illumination of the spiritual mind. Therefore, it is the false light. The false light is finally overcome and redeemed by the true light of the soul, called the second Logos or Christ. The secret processes by which the Luciferian intellect is transmuted into the Christly intellect constitute one of the great secrets of alchemy and are symbolized by the process of transmuting base metals into gold.
Thank you, Yvonne. Okay, first, MPH describes recognition of the three suns by Hermetists, and then cites a quote from Paracelsus, who was born in 1493. Paracelsus was a Swiss physician, alchemist, philosopher, and theologian of the German Renaissance. He's considered to be the father of toxicology, study of poisons, and a pioneer of chemistry and medicine. He also wrote on astrology, occultism, and mysticism. He was almost certainly an initiate. And it's just interesting that such an occult teaching was recognized and written about as early as the 15th, 16th century. Could we get a reader, please?
Vivian, can you read that for us, please?
The unity of the universe, excuse me, was asserted by Paracelsus, who says that the human body is possessed of primeval stuff or cosmic matter. The spectroscope has proved the assertion by showing that the same chemical elements which exist upon Earth and in the Sun are also found in all the stars. The spectroscope does more. It shows that all the stars are suns, similar in constitution to our own. And as we are told by Professor Meyer van Helmont, who was a disciple of Paracelsus, says much the same.
Yeah, so this is oddly worded, he says here. And as we are told by Professor Meyer, van Helmont, who was a disciple of Paracelsus, says much the same. So he runs two names together here. Okay, and this quote continues. Could we get a reader, please? This is all from Isis Unveiled.
Martha, can you please read that for us?
Yes, I can. I did have a question. Wasn't Paracelsus also the alchemist who was beginning to shift the science away from the purely mineral metal transmutation into a more energetic? Yeah, okay.
Well, it's a parallel discipline, one being a kind of blind for the other. So you can speak only of sulfur and mercury and lead and gold and these different solutions. And any true alchemist will know what you're talking about in terms of transformation of the personality. So they had a full system in place on the physical side to describe the what is now described in the Ageless Wisdom teachings through theology.
Okay, thank you. So the true alchemy was kind of timeless. Got it. Okay.
Yeah, and always referred to the transformation of the personality into the true self.
Right. Okay, I think in Christianity that they gave Paracelsus a special look and rejected it again. But anyway, it doesn't matter.
they were tempted for a moment.
Yeah, that's what I was. And please ignore my chat. BL, it's irrelevant now. Okay, here we go. Quote, in our dreams, says Paracelsus, quote, we are like the plants, which have also the elementary and vital body, but possess not the spirit. In our sleep, the astral body is free and can, by the elasticity of its nature, either hover round in proximity with its sleeping vehicle or soar higher to hold converse with its starry parents, or even communicate with its brothers at great distances. Dreams are prophetic character. Prescience and present wants are the faculties of the astral spirit. Did I read that correct? I hope I did. Into our elementary and grosser body, these gifts are not imparted. For a death, it descends into the bosom of the earth and is reunited to the physical elements, while the several spirits return to the stars. The animals, he adds, have also their presentiments, for they too have an astral body. This is from Isis Unveiled, page 186, volume 1.
Thank you, Martha. Yeah, you know, it's pretty clear that he had an elevated state of consciousness for him to be able to, because he wrote a lot from observation in his own nature. So, yeah. Okay, next up, certain Rosicrucian scholars have given special appellations to these three phases of the sun. The spiritual sun they call Vulcan, the solar and intellectual sun, Christ and Lucifer, respectively, and the material sun, the Jewish Demiurgus, Jehovah. So, though to my mind, this is a exoteric listing, there is some truth in these Rosicrucian correspondences. DK gives us more insight on the relation between Vulcan, the sun, and Christ in this passage from Esoteric Astrology. Could we get a reader, please?
Yes. Magda, can you read that for us, please?
Yes. Vulcan is the ray or planet of isolation. Its influence eventually leads to what has been called in the Christian phraseology the Gethsemane experience. The Christ kneeling beside the rock, symbolic of the adepts, of the depths, I'm sorry, of the mineral kingdom and of the activity of Vulcan, the fashioner, rises his eyes upward to where the light of revelation breaks forth and knows at the moment what it is he has to do. Such is the test of Vulcan, ruling Taurus of the soul, ruling desire of the Son of God, fashioning his instrument of expression in the depths, grasping the divine purpose, and so bending the will of the little self to that of the greater self. The depths have been reached, and there is no more to be done. The light from the eye of the bull, which with ever-increasing radiance has guided the struggling soul, must give place eventually to the light of the sun, for Vulcan is a substitute for the sun. It is spoken of sometimes as being veiled by the sun, and at others it stands for the sun itself. It stands between the man and the sun, the soul.
Thank you. Yeah, I especially like this passage. It brings the influence of the three suns via Vulcan, the Christ, and the actual sun into a kind of relevance, you know, for an experience that we will have as we come into soul awareness and soul infusion. Okay, any thoughts, questions on anything? So next up, Lucifer here represents the intellectual mind without the illumination of the spiritual mind. Therefore, it is the false light. False light is finally overcome and redeemed by the true light of the soul, called the second logos, or Christ. This passage suggests the split between higher and lower mind and the potential for a lower mind-centered person to deepen his or her personality orientation through increased identification with the false light of intellect, an illusory condition that MPH falsely attributes to Lucifer. The ageless wisdom teaches that Lucifer, along with Prometheus and the serpent from the Garden of Eden, brought the light of mind to humanity, without which no redemption is possible. Finally, the secret process by which the Luciferian intellect is transmuted into the Christly intellect constitute one of the great secrets of alchemy and are symbolized by the process of transmuting base metals into gold. So Christly intellect is Atmabuddhi Manas. The transmutation of base metals into gold, alchemy's greatest allegory, involves three main stages. But before we get into that, let's pick up Yvonne's question.
Go ahead, please.
This was just about a minute ago. I think somebody said that Vulcan is synonymous with the sun.
Yeah, that's in this. He talks about this here. Vulcan is a substitute for the sun. It is spoken of sometimes as being veiled by the sun, and at others it stands for the sun itself.
I just didn't understand that one. I thought they were two separate entities. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's the idea is it's like all veiling. It steps down or transforms the energy to make it available at lower levels of consciousness. You know, whenever you see a veiling, you know, mostly we talk about the moon being moon veiling one of three planets, but there is this persistent indication that the sun, that Vulcan is veiled by the sun, right? And the idea is that they that Vulcan is, because it's a planet and not a solar entity, that energy is made available through this veiling. That's my understanding anyway. Okay, let's get back to this. All right. Oh, that's right. So we're here. The three stages I'll just pick up where with my notes. Christly intellect is Atmabuddhi Manas, the transmutation of base metals into gold. Alchemy's greatest allegory involves three main stages: nigredo, albedo, and rubedo. Nigredo is a stage of dissolution and death, where lead is melted and separated from its impurities. Thus, it represents aspirational consciousness. It actually can also represent completely personality consciousness, or that sleep stage. Note the detail at right of the white bird representing albedo, dominating the nigredo aspect. This symbolizes recognition of one's own faults, weaknesses, and attachments to the material world. To bring about this recognition, one must assume the perspective of the observer, which leads to awareness of one's dweller on the threshold. Albedo is the stage of washing, whitening, and rebirth, where the purified lead is mixed with mercury and silver to form a white substance. This symbolizes the purifications of one's emotions and lower mind, leading to soul contact and the awakening of one's higher consciousness. The third phase, rubedo, is the stage of coagulation, reddening, and perfection, where the white substance of the previous stage is heated and combined with sulfur and gold to form a red substance. This symbolizes the integration of the lower mind with one's higher consciousness, as well as the attainment of the philosopher's stone, the ultimate goal of alchemy. The three stages are also depicted as an integrated trimurti, with each element contained within the other two elements, indicated by a small yin-yang symbol, thus suggesting their inherent unity. The three in one at every phase. It's just what is active, right? It's a fascinating system. Of course, we're barely touching on it because all these qualities that he describes, the red substance, the white substance, the what is meant by heating and combining, the purpose of sulfur, all this is a deep study. But at least we get a sense of the analogy here. Okay. Next up, we get a reader, please. Oh, see a hand?
Yes. Please go ahead, Magda.
I was wondering what in the little three dots inside the three colors in this image Like in the white, there is a horizontal line, black, red. Inside the red, there is a
right
obliquous line, curved line, black and white. And in the black, there is a vertical middle line between the white and the red. How could that be interpreted?
Okay, it's as I said, with within, let's just start with Negretto. Within this stage of personality consciousness, which is also the stage that which represents aspiration, there are the other two stages, the transitional or the second aspect, and the monadic or that final philosopher's stone aspect, which is represented by the red. And by the white being the soul aspect or the second aspect, and the red being the highest or monadic aspect. The position of the dividing line is just the relationship of the entire circle to this particular shape, which is this teardrop shape. You know,
it's the shape relationship. That's it.
It's a shape relationship. Yeah, I don't think there's anything more inferred by that. So you have shape relationship here and here. But it's really a fascinating concept. I'm actually glad you brought us back to it because, you know, you really could contemplate, you know, for instance, the fact that without this seed, you could never escape personality reality. There would be nothing that would drive you to the next stage, you know. And you could say the same thing, you know, in this case, for instance, the albedo, that which is being purified is represented, that's the negredo, and that which is the source of the impulse towards purity is the rubedo, you see. So in each one, you can draw a relationship to the other two. And I think that's a very important aspect of alchemy.
Thank you.
Yeah, you bet. Okay, reader, please.
Greg.
Okay, in the rare treatise, in the rare treatise, The Secret Symbols of Rosicrucians, Franz Hartmann defines the sun alchemically as the symbol of wisdom, the center of power or heart of things. The sun is a center of energy and a storehouse of power. Each living being contains within itself a center of life, which may grow to be a sun. In the heart of the regenerated, the divine power stimulated by the light of the Logos grows into a sun which illuminates his mind. In a note, the same author amplifies his description by adding, the terrestrial sun is the image or reflection of the invisible celestial sun. The former is in the realm of spirit, what the latter is in the realm of matter. But the latter receives its power from the former. In the majority of cases, the religions of antiquity agree that the material visible sun was a reflector rather than a source of power. The sun was sometimes represented as a shield carried on the arm of the sun god, as for example, Frey, the Scandinavian solar deity. This sun reflected the light of the invisible spiritual sun, which was the true source of life, light, and truth. The physical nature of the universe is receptive. It is a realm of effects. The invisible causes of these effects belong to the spiritual world. Hence, the spiritual world is the sphere of causation. The material world is the sphere of effects, while the intellectual or soul world is the sphere of mediation. Thus Christ, the personified higher intellect and soul nature, is called the mediator, who by virtue of his position and And power says, no man cometh to the Father but by me.
Thank you, Greg. Okay, so first, in the rare treatise, The Secret Symbols of the Rosicrucians, Franz Hartmann defines the sun alchemically as the symbol of wisdom, the center of power or heart of things. The sun is a center of energy and a storehouse of power. So here's Hartmann's beautifully illustrated The Secret Symbols of the Rosicrucians. There's a number of these kinds of plates in this book that are just fascinating to consider. Just as do Masons and Theosophists, Rosicrucians recognize the sun as the source of all energy within our solar system. Continuing with the quote, by the way, MPH in Los Angeles, you know, he lived into the 90s, I believe it was, and his Philosophical Research Center, which is a library temple meeting house kind of place in Los Angeles, was absolutely spectacular. The library was like nothing I'd ever seen. I was there a couple of times. And in fact, I bought the book that we're working from in signed copy from that PRC. But the library is, he has all these books. And, you know, because in 1926, for those of you born after year 2000, there was no internet in 1926. So he had to do all this research himself. And he had the most phenomenal library. And this is just one of his many books. So anyway, just an aside on that. Yes, Yvonne.
This is just an aside too. Which degree do you think he was, like a third degree initiate or something?
It's really hard to know with someone. He really was a scholar. He may have been no more than a first initiate. It's really hard to say. But the nature of his life was one of pure dedication to the getting the word out, you know, to education. There's actually more material in his monthly magazines. Well, they were even weekly for a period over decades and decades. I mean, he started these in the 20s and they went up through the 90s. And I was able to download them all. And they're just the most extraordinary source of information. You may have seen me once in a while quote from one of these magazines. This just took, 60 years of dedication to, you know, spreading the ageless wisdom. So, you know, all you can say is that almost certainly he was an initiate of some level, but it's hard to say what. Okay, how are we doing here? You know, I think this might be a good place to stop. In fact, we'll probably back up, reread this, and that'll be where we stop. This is where we'll start next time. So, thank you all. Do you want to give some dates, BL?
Sure, but I'd like to give a reminder. I think there were at least two slides that had that error in the mutable and cardinal cross. So before you send them on to me.
Okay.
All right. The next immediate webinar is the TCF webinar on the 8th of March.
Right. That's Friday.
Right. That's
in a few days. Yeah.
And then on the 17th of March, we have the Secret Doctrine. And that's after we change to daylight savings time here in the States. So the webinars will now change after the 10th of March to 7 p.m. GMT.
Now that's going to be different, and for those of you in Europe, because I think you change a couple of weeks later, so you'll have to just check. Best thing to do is just go to morifederation.com and look at the information around the links and determine what time your time is for them.
Yeah, because it's got converters, right?
Yeah, right. That's right. Okay, real good.
And then the next secret teaching of all ages is going to be on the 7th of April.
Righty. Okay, thank you all for coming as we continue our journey through this amazing book. And we'll see you next time.
Thank you, everybody. Okay. Goodbye.